Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. George Dimitri to talk about what's new in GIST, and to begin, he provided an overview of the field.
I think a lot of medical oncologists in the country and around the world are now used to seeing patients with gastrointestinal stromal tumors. Before the year 2000, nobody really saw this disease because it wasn't diagnosed as such. They were seeing these awful intestinal sarcomas, and they were put in these bins, and nobody really knew what to do with them. In the year 2000, we had identified the causative mutation, the first one, the most common one, in the signaling enzyme called KIT, and suddenly that drove the diagnostic testing that led to more and more patients getting diagnosed with GIST. We used to think GIST was a true orphan disease. Now we know that GIST is the same incidence as Hodgkin's disease. A lot of GIST patients around right now, and they're living longer because of some of the targeted therapies. A lot of our patients, if they present at their first presentation with metastases, it's almost always somewhere in the abdomen, most commonly to the omentum or to the liver or somewhere else in the abdomen per se. And the standard response, very appropriately, is to start somebody on imatinib, because imatinib worldwide still is the gold standard for first-line therapy of metastatic GIST. And we all know that most patients get benefit from imatinib. A good two-thirds will get objective responses and shrinkage. Another about 20% will have prolonged stable disease. So people get great activity with imatinib. We're still following about 17% of the first GIST patients in the world that we put on in the year 2000 who have never had to change their imatinib ever. They're just still taking it, still doing great. Unfortunately, most patients aren't in that lucky category. About half of the patients will have the beneficial effects of imatinib wear off and have some evidence of disease resistance after about 2 years. And then after another 2 years, by 4 or 5 years, virtually another 40% of patients will have progression occur. So I think the key thing is to think of these patients as they come through that process from first presentation to as long as imatinib works to control their disease. And at that point, something will happen. It differs in different people. In many patients we've seen, a patient may have several tumors throughout their abdomen and their liver, and then after about 2 years or 3 years, maybe one of 3 or 4 or even 40 tumors, only one will start to grow. So an interesting question is, what do you do if only one part of the disease is growing? Do you stop the imatinib? Do you do something else? And so through a lot of experience, our group has basically taken that point to be the multidisciplinary evaluation point. This is where we call in our expert surgeons and say, is this one lump that's progressing in this patient, is this an easy to take out lump? And at that point, if the surgeon says, sure, it's on a corner of the liver, I can easily take this out without disturbing much of anything, or it's in a corner of the abdomen away from any vital structure, I can easily take that out, that's really a good thing to do if the patient's in good performance status and otherwise could tolerate that kind of surgery.
You know, this concept is something that oncologists are hearing about in a number of tumors. When you were talking, I was just flashing on a conversation I had with Ross Kamage about ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer patients on crizotinib. Same kind of situation you described. They're under good control and, quote, you know, breakthrough with some sort of single lesion. Do we know anything about the biology, what's going on?
We know a ton of the biology, and that's why these mutant kinase-driven diseases are going to go into a bin different from most other cancers, where we just think of it as a systemic disease right from the get-go. And this is why, after many, many patients like this have had their tumors taken out, we've actually examined that tumor that comes out, and lo and behold, there's a second mutation in that tumor that confers the resistance to imatinib. But when our surgeons go in, sometimes they get a little lump of something that's nearby but is stable. And when we examine that other lump that's not growing, it doesn't have the secondary resistance mutation. So clearly, we're watching the evolution of the disease, just like you can watch the evolution of resistance in bacteria in a bad infectious population, let's say.
Interesting. Is there any patient that you can recall who was in this situation, just in terms of being more specific in terms of sites of where you see these resistant tumors?
You know, it doesn't really matter. We've seen them in the abdomen, around the omentum, in the liver. I think the only limiting factor is, can the surgeon get to it easily? Is it worth putting the patient through an operation to take out an oligoclonal progression? And when I say oligo, I mean even two or three. I'm not thinking 40 tumors progressing all over the belly. We view that as systemic progression, and it really is. But we have lots of patients who have one, two, or three different sites who may be progressing, and our surgeons have gotten very good at going in, cherry-picking those things out. And then the right thing to do is to leave those patients on imatinib because clearly it's controlling the rest of their disease, and you've taken out the things that are resistant. Now, of course, we then tell the patient, this is probably just the tip of the iceberg. You almost certainly have other tumors that will now start to grow elsewhere, so we'll continue to watch you really carefully. But I'll tell you, the second person in the world to ever take imatinib, who's still on imatinib, was in this position about 5 years after he started the imatinib. He had all sorts of metastases through his belly, through his liver. Then one of the things in his liver started to grow. He had that taken out, and we left him on imatinib, and we're glad we did, because frankly, the rest of his disease, amazingly, has never grown another resistance mutation.
What about the situation where you do believe it's systemic progression on imatinib? How do you think through second-line therapy?
That is clearly the majority of patients. Okay, so I just wanted to emphasize that just because a patient's breaking through imatinib, we don't necessarily immediately reach for the second drug. I think that's a good time for the multidisciplinary consultation with an expert surgeon who really knows how to do this and would not put the patient through an operation for nothing. But let's say the patient has more progressive disease in multiple locations. The standard second-line therapy, again, worldwide, is sunitinib. Sunitinib definitely has activity in this disease. We know why in many patients it works, because the most common resistance mutation is a gatekeeper mutation, something that just sort of swings in to where imatinib would ordinarily bind. But because imatinib is a pretty big molecule, this thing swings in, acts like an elbow, and keeps the imatinib from going into that binding pocket. Sunitinib is a smaller molecule, so it can slip under that elbow, and it actually works in these gatekeeper mutations. Sounds a lot like lung cancer with the EGF receptor mutations, right? The gatekeeper mutations are some of the things that really make erlotinib fail in lung cancer, and these gatekeepers are also what makes some of the BCR-ABLE failures in CML, also with imatinib. So there's a similarity between all of these kinase-driven diseases. Now, sunitinib, because it is a smaller molecule, it can slip in there. Sunitinib has more side effects than imatinib. It has a different spectrum also because it is a VEGF receptor inhibitor, causes high blood pressure. So a lot of people don't want to move to that because it certainly has some more side effects than imatinib. But I'll tell you, if you need it, it is a very effective drug, especially if you've got a gatekeeper mutation.
Now, of course, another player on the scene and now approved is regorafenib, and you've been very involved with research and with this agent, the GRID study, et cetera. Maybe you can review a little bit about what we know at this point about that strategy and whether there are any situations where you might want to consider it, if you can, even before sunitinib.
So regorafenib, like sunitinib, is also a very potent VEGF receptor inhibitor and also has a number of other kinase targets that it inhibits. Also, like sunitinib, it does not inhibit ABLE, so it's not a leukemia drug. Sunitinib is not a CML drug either because of that. When we were developing other drugs to take over after imatinib and sunitinib failed, we looked at regorafenib, and it has a very different kinetic of binding to the mutant receptor. It's a little bit slower on, and then it seems to hang on longer. It also has different active metabolites. So for a variety of reasons, we actually like this agent, looked like it worked in the laboratory. And Dr. Suzanne George at our institution ran a multi-center study with Meg von Marin at Fox Chase and Mike Heinrich out at Oregon, and really showed that this drug looked like it could do something different and rescue a sizable percentage of patients after imatinib and sunitinib had failed. So the GRID study that you referred to was the definitive worldwide phase 3 trial that tested regorafenib in patients after they had had the disease progress despite prior imatinib and sunitinib. And a good 40% of those patients also had some other kinase inhibitor that was investigational or unapproved for GIST, most commonly nilotinib, and a few had had some others. Regorafenib definitely was able to have a significant effect to control the disease even after two other prior tyrosine kinase inhibitors, sunitinib and imatinib, had failed. So clearly, right now, the FDA agreed with this, and the FDA gave regorafenib the approved indication in the United States for controlling TKI-resistant GIST, and it is the standard third-line therapy here. Now, you ask a good question. Is there any situation in which it would move into second line? At this point, we still go through the rather standard pathway that I just described to you. Imatinib first, sunitinib second, regorafenib third. Do I think it might do better in second line? We actually have no idea of knowing. There's some very interesting research going on with our molecular colleague, John Fletcher at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Suzanne George with some others, who have some very interesting sequencing data that say we might be able to actually do better by patients if we mix these together and go from one to the other. Almost the opposite of what you think about doing an infectious disease.
So in other words, switching before progression.
Switching before progression. It's a study that we're writing. We're actually very excited about it, but it needs to be tested. These are all hypotheses.
What's the design of the study?
We're still working on that.
What are you thinking about?
Well, we're thinking about putting them on one drug and then changing them to the other drug. We're actually just trying to model that in some of the cell lines about how long you have to be on one drug. Is it 4 days? Is it 4 weeks? So things like that. That's what we're thinking about.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more about the GRID study and exactly what was seen and whether or not you can do any indirect comparisons, both from the studies as well as your own clinical experience in terms of efficacy and toxicity of regorafenib as opposed to sunitinib, for example.
Yeah, well, the GRID study was a big international effort that really involved expert GIST physicians in every country, United States, Europe, Asia, you name it, people collaborated on this. And at the end of the study, we had about 200 patients who were randomized 2-to-1 to receive either blinded regorafenib or blinded placebo after progressing on at least imatinib and sunitinib. And what we found was that this is a pretty nasty disease after those two standard drugs have failed. The group that got randomized to the placebo had the mean time of progression less than 1 month. 0.9 months, basically, which means, you know, half the patients progressed in a couple of weeks after going on study. That's not so different than the original sunitinib registration trial either. In other words, some people look at GIST as kind of a pussycat disease because it's a single kinase that drives it, but it is a very aggressive disease once they become resistant in general. So the nice thing about the design of the GRID study, and the FDA agreed with us that we could design it this way, is that even if a patient got started on placebo, they were able at the time of progression to cross over to get unblinded active regorafenib. So all of us who were doing the study ethically felt good about that study design. We were able to take these patients who were progressing and not just say, too bad you got the placebo, now here's hospice, but we're able to say, too bad you got the placebo, but it's only been a few weeks, here's the regorafenib. And actually, the regorafenib was at that point able to control their disease just as if they had started on it. So we feel like we did a good study and didn't hurt patients to prove that the drug worked. So we were very happy about that. The group that started on the regorafenib, their tumors were controlled in general for about 5 months, a little under 5 months, compared to less than 1 month for the group that started on placebo. Now again, compared to imatinib that works for a median of about 2 years, 5 months doesn't sound very long, and it's not, but that's only because there are other resistant clones that are popping up in the background, and many of those patients stayed on the regorafenib to continue to control the bulk of their disease. Yet another hypothesis. Should patients who have some small degree of progression, even if it counts as objective progression, would they do better by staying on a kinase inhibitor, continuous kinase suppression?
What did you see in terms of response rates and overall in general in this kind of situation? What fraction of patients clinically do you expect to improve?
Well, the response rates for any drug after imatinib fails are really quite low. Sunitinib had a response rate of about 8 to 11%, depending on where you catch the numbers. This study had a response rate of less than 7 to 8%. That's about what you see. Not a lot of patients were having objective shrinkage of their tumor. But that's dramatically different than about 70% of patients who actually control their disease. There is a nice, durable, stable disease rate of about 2/3 of the patients. So That's the important thing about GIST. We feel that just by locking the tumor into a static state, patients have control of their disease. They certainly feel better. They're not having as much pain. And then eventually you're waiting for some other clones to grow out, resistance to kick in, more symptoms to develop, and other therapies to be needed in the future.
What about side effects and tolerability? Of course, you know, the drug is now being used in colorectal cancer, and I've kind of been hearing from people this concept that a lot of patients have difficulties, but you can get most people through it. Is that your experience?
It is absolutely a learning curve to use this drug. We in the GIST world have been used to using multi-targeted kinase inhibitors like sunitinib for years. And I would say the similarities between these two drugs, sunitinib and regorafenib, are notable. They're both VEGF receptor inhibitors. There's something about a VEGF receptor inhibitor with a PDGF receptor inhibitor, both of them hit both of those targets, that also gives you this hand-foot syndrome. And that's, as we know from other agents, that's not a fun side effect for patients, but it's extremely manageable. If doctors are tuned into that, they can figure it out early before blisters happen and then help the patients to really prevent them from getting worse and actually stay on the drug. In fact, in the phase 3 regorafenib study, we had less than 5% of patients who had to come off study for any kind of side effect. It was terrific. The doctors did a great job of figuring out how to use the drug and actually keep the patients on a drug that would help them.
There was actually a presentation at ASCO last year on a urea cream that was used to prevent hand-foot with sorafenib, and I actually heard a couple of GIST people bring that up as a possibility when using regorafenib. Is that something you've ever tried?
We have, and actually our nurses have a small cottage industry of trying all sorts of interesting emollients and these gloves and all sorts of folk remedies that I think probably do help. I'm not sure one helps better than another, and, you know, we've been thinking about having, you know, Nurse Kathy's emollient cream or something to help. But the bottom line is, as long as patients are tuned into this, and I actually think almost any emollient would help, I think this is a very manageable side effect. I also think that doctors need to understand the variability in pharmacology between all of these kinase inhibitors, imatinib, sunitinib, regorafenib. If you take 10 patients, line them up in a room, the pharmacology differences between them will be literally an order of magnitude. So that's why you can't just take a standard dose off the shelf and expect it'll be the right dose for that patient. We really need to personalize the dosing of these based on side effects and tolerability.
You know, mentioning sorafenib, it is chemically very similar to regorafenib, but what do we know about sorafenib and GIST?
So you're right, there is only one fluoride atom difference between regorafenib and sorafenib. In many ways, sorafenib is defluorinated regorafenib. But that fluorine does seem to change the pharmacology, importantly, of regorafenib. Even one little change in a molecule can make a big clinical difference. We do know that sorafenib has some activity in GIST. There was an NCI-supported study that Hedy Kindler and colleagues at the University of Chicago were running in collaboration with Bob Mackey and Meg von Meeren again. And our experience is also that it can work. It's not at all clear whether it works after regorafenib fails. So that's an interesting research question. And the converse is also true. We have no idea whether regorafenib works in people who have been previously exposed to sorafenib. So they are similar. We will probably eventually get more details about that. But at this point, since regorafenib is the FDA-approved drug for GIST and sorafenib is not, we're seeing most patients and their doctors leaning towards regorafenib. And then the only question that would come up is there any value of sorafenib if regorafenib fails?
As you see people who've been managed primarily in the community maybe come to you for a second opinion, are there any myths or misperceptions about regorafenib or systemic therapy in general with GIST that you see?
No, I think the hardest thing with GIST is that people have heard so much mythology about the responses of GIST to kinase inhibitors. There's all this talk about how you can't rely on any kind of response criteria. Well, that's true and in some ways unrelated. To me, the response criteria we're used to in most solid tumors is whether a tumor actually shrinks. We certainly know you can have a massive beneficial biological response in a GIST and never see the tumor shrink. So as long as you're willing to accept that, and I say that based on real evidence, there's real evidence that that is a true biological effect that benefits patients. As long as you accept that, it doesn't matter, frankly, if the tumor shrinks. It sounds like a weird thing to say, but it's absolutely true. And then it really doesn't matter if you look at response rates. As long as you mix durable, stable disease in with tumor shrinkage, we have the same percentage of helping patients. The only other mythology that I think is important to get out there is that if a tumor's growing, you can trust your gut. That's a bad thing. The only thing to watch out for is if the patient is bleeding inside a tumor, which frankly isn't subtle. The hematocrit will go down, hemoglobin will go down, and it will be obvious that this patient is having an intratumoral bleed. But that's a 1 in 100 scenario. Most likely, if the tumor is getting bigger, that patient has resistant disease and needs to be managed differently. But I've seen a lot of patients referred in where they say, well, I've heard you can't, you know, rely on response criteria. I knew the tumor was getting bigger, but I figured we should still keep them on, pick your drug, imatinib or something. And we say, no, now's a really good time to change therapy.
So it sounds like you're saying that it may be different than other solid tumors. A tumor mass can remain the same, but yet something's going on inside, which is actually an anti-tumor effect?
That's true. We actually see this phenomenon also in kidney cancer sometimes, and we actually have seen it in some of the EGF receptor and ALK-driven lung cancers. It just hasn't been publicized as much. I think we will see this more, that what winds up happening is the inside of the tumor is actually destroyed, but the edges of the tumor, for some reason, are able to stay alive and keep the shape of the tumor. That's why most doctors who are used to treating GISTs are very used to seeing the density of the tumor change on CT imaging. It starts out kind of gray and solid, and then after a month on an effective kinase inhibitor, it gets all dark, almost water density. And that's because most of the inside of the tumor has gone through this myxoid degenerative change.
So let's talk about adjuvant therapy. And you brought up a clinical scenario of a patient with a localized GIST of the stomach with 6 centimeters, and the pathologist is saying 6 mitoses per 50 high-powered fields on microscopic review. How do you think through this kind of clinical situation?
Well, I think it's important for every oncologist now to understand something about the kinds of patients the surgeons may be sending to medical oncologists. Because increasingly, surgeons are taking things out, they're getting diagnosed as GISTs, and they know that imatinib is approved with a survival benefit in the adjuvant setting. So they want to send those patients to medical oncologists to have that discussion about, is adjuvant therapy indicated? Here's where doctors need to educate ourselves about what are the risk factors for recurrence. It is quite clear that there are 3 major risk factors. Where did the disease start? Did it start in the stomach, the small intestine, the rectum, extra gastrointestinal? So anatomy is destiny there. It matters how big the tumor was, and generally we think about these things, are they less than 5 centimeters, are they bigger than 5 centimeters? There are rules about this. And then how active is the disease mitotically? And here it's not a very good staging system we have. Typically it's 5 or fewer mitoses per 50 high-powered fields, or more than 5 mitoses per 50 high-powered fields. So we see a lot of pathology reports that amazingly just happen to have 5 mitoses per 50 high-powered fields. What probably is going on there is that you find 1 mitosis in 10 fields, you multiply by 5, and you get the number 5. That's why a disproportionate number of these path reports probably have the number 5 on it.
You know, George Sledge has made the same point about tumor size in breast cancer. It's always by 0.5 centimeters.
That's right. That's exactly right. So that's why I said, in this case, I chose 6 just to kick it into a high-risk club, a putative high-risk club. Shall we say, insensitive, the current risk assessment system is, with that situation, a 6-centimeter primary, gastric primary location, and 6 mitoses per 50 high-powered fields, the risk of that patient, the risk you have to quote that patient, is that that patient would have a 55% chance of having the tumor come back. If you change the path report and now only make it 5 mitoses per 50 high-powered fields, you would have to tell the patient they only have a 4% chance the disease would come back. Now, do I believe there's that much of a difference based on 1 mitosis that you would find? Of course not. But that's what's wrong with our current staging system.
You know, I'm curious about this because obviously, you know, GIST is a whole lot less common than the other adjuvant solid tumors oncologists are familiar with in colon, lung, and breast. But I think there people are used to one way or the other kind of figuring out a number, a risk for recurrence. And there are nomograms out there for GIST. So even though, you know, you have to consider what you're saying about the number if you have it on the borderline with mitoses, is this decision really ultimately based on what your assessed risk of relapse is?
I think it is. I also think that it's a very personal decision amongst patients. Even though the data from this German-Scandinavian trial had a survival outcome benefit, it's not at all clear that you really need to take adjuvant therapy. In my heart of hearts, I still feel that we're treating somewhat early to delay recurrence, but that we're not really getting a cure out of this. Adjuvant therapy of a bad risk GIST simply delays the inevitable. So an alternative approach could be to just follow that patient, if they're compliant, with close imaging, wait for the disease to come back, and then treat the recurrent metastatic disease at that point, and frankly, leave them on imatinib or some other TKI lifelong at that point. So that's a little bit fatalistic on my part, but I actually think it's probably more reality-based. I don't think we're curing people with adjuvant imatinib therapy right now.
You know, because if you take, again, the common paradigms, for example, in breast cancer, one of the things that kind of surprised me is it seems like the bar in GIST is pretty high. I've heard, you know, people talk about having a 50% risk necessary in order to justify adjuvant treatment. There are many cases where a patient might have a 20 or 20% risk. But, I mean, understanding your thoughts in terms of the paradigm with what's really going on here, but yet when you make the analogy, for example, to giving chemotherapy in some of these other solid tumors, which is done sometimes with patients at 10% risk, it seems like imatinib is maybe would it be consideration at lower risk.
I think you're right, but I also think that reflects experts' concepts that we're probably not curing anybody. We're just delaying the recurrence. And that, I think, is playing into this. I think even the aggressive, treatment-friendly imatinib people for the adjuvant setting are generally saying if you've got a 20% risk or higher, that justifies giving imatinib therapy. I think very few people are saying if you've got a 10% risk of recurrence, give the adjuvant therapy. I think generally we're sitting in the 20 or 25% bin. And even then, we don't try to talk patients into that because the alternative is just to wait for the disease, see if it's going to recur, and then treat at that point.
I have to say I'm a little bit surprised to hear you talk about your concept in terms of the fact that maybe it doesn't really affect the ultimate outcome here. Do most GIST investigators believe that?
Yeah, and I think that's what the data really supports, because if you look at the time to recurrence while you're actually taking the imatinib in the adjuvant setting, virtually nobody recurs. But within 6 months after stopping the adjuvant therapy, the rates of recurrence parallel what the original placebo group were doing. So the failure rates dramatically increase after the adjuvant therapy is stopped. So that actually has led to the other treatment paradigm, that if I've got a 40-year-old who has a really bad GIST at risk of recurrence, the other alternative is just to say, you know what, if I were you, I would take the imatinib, keep the disease at bay forever. Why would I stop treating? And we have a lot of patients who agree with that. We don't have data about that, but we are doing a study of 5-year adjuvant imatinib. And when you get right down to it, that makes good sense. After all, if you look at how long you gave tamoxifen in the early days of testing tamoxifen, it wasn't 1 year, it wasn't 3 years, it was a minimum of 5 years. So I think that's where we're going here. We're going towards longer duration adjuvant therapy, and that does make sense to me.
And as of December, it's now gotten pushed out to 10 years. Well, how do you approach the issue of duration? And if you treat a patient at lower risk, do you use a shorter duration?
Well, I think the standard duration right now is 3 years. Based on all the evidence we've seen, if you're going to bother with adjuvant therapy, you try to get somebody to 3 years. I think, though, most of the patients that I give adjuvant therapy to, I don't see any reason to stop. If they're high enough risk to even bother putting them on adjuvant therapy, they're high enough risk not to stop the therapy. And actually, the FDA approval in the adjuvant setting is not time delimited. It just says, you know, adjuvant therapy is indicated in GIST at sufficient risk of relapse.
What's your own clinical experience with imatinib in the adjuvant setting in terms of tolerability? What fraction of patients sort of cruise through like it's a placebo? What fraction have to be stopped? What fraction have some problems, but you can get them through it?
Well, I think 100% of patients have some problems, but you could get them through it. But I also have seen that about 30% of patients get tired in the adjuvant setting of the side effects, which aren't that bad. But frankly, they're bad enough that people say, you know what, if I had metastatic disease, I could live with a little diarrhea and swelling and, you know, tiredness. But you're telling me my disease might not come back. If it comes back, then I'll deal with those side effects. So we've seen about 30% of patients who voluntarily take themselves off the drug, not for such medically severe side effects, but frankly for patient preference. And I respect that. I really see where they're coming from.